I don't know how many of you have ever heard of a man called Charles Garman. Charles Garman is probably a name with which you're not familiar. I didn't never heard of him until a couple months ago. I was reading a biography about Calvin Coolidge, and Garman was one of his instructors, and I came across this quote. Garman said, "The most satisfied men in history are not those who have received the largest pay, but those who have rendered the greatest service to their age." I think about that. And Garman isn't saying it's wrong to be compensated or be compensated generously. He's alluding to priorities. That, men, our lives must count for something more than our livelihood. For us, as believing men, it means letting God order those priorities. And isn't that the very essence of Job's life? A testimony which still speaks to millions of people today. Now, let me ask you this question. Do you think Job could have foreseen that? Do you think Job felt the same way you do when all kinds of trouble's going on in your life? Praying to God is like talking through a basement ceiling that's 8 feet thick. No one can comfort you. You feel all alone. And yet, the life of Job, my guess is, next to Jesus, has probably touched more people than anybody else in the Bible. You can ask unsaved people, they know the name of Job. My grandson thought it was the book of Job, but it's the book of Job. He couldn't have foreseen that. I don't like going through trouble and hardship and difficulty and pain and suffering any more than the next guy does, but I have learned to some degree that the reason we go through these things is to be a blessing to other people who are going to have to go through them. And I'm telling you, if this church should have anything, it should be a wealth of knowledge and experience on that subject. You can say amen to that because that's a good thing. That doesn't make looking forward to struggles or going through them any easier, but it gives us something to believe in that's biblical. How is it that we can be successful in raising one child and not another? David and Solomon were so close, but David and Absalom? Oh, man. Isn't there just a list of things I can do to ensure that I will always love my wife and my children and they'll turn out to love God? Can't you just give me the magic formula? And I say, you might as well ask me how to nail Jell-O to a tree. Read 1 Chronicles 28 and 29, and you will see how David set Solomon up for success. Read those chapters when you go home today or sometime this week. David set Solomon. Solomon's the wisest man in the world. He built the temple. When you read 1 Chronicles 28 and 29, you'll get an entirely different picture because David set Solomon up. David did all the work. He got all the resources. He got the workers. He set it all up, the plans. Now, Solomon was a wise son, right? He was a wise man. He saw the benefits of his father's instruction and investment. And so you know what he tries to do? He tries to set his son Rehoboam up for success. Remember who Rehoboam is? Rehoboam is the successor to Solomon. He's supposed to take over the kingdom when Solomon dies. 1 Kings 11 and 12, bad story, bad story. Why? Because Rehoboam did not listen to his father. And the destructive consequences were not just personal in Rehoboam's life or domestic in his family, but they were national. That is when the kingdom split. And Israel, the northern kingdom, did not have one righteous king in over 230 years. You know what the wisdom of the book of Proverbs is? It's the instruction compiled by Solomon for the well-being of his son. I learned this some time ago when I was reading Proverbs. And I discovered in the first seven chapters, 17 times, Solomon begins various sections by saying, "My son," or "My sons, listen to me." Solomon is writing the book of Proverbs for Rehoboam. Yeah, his other boys will get a copy too, but it's for the heir. Your dad's the smartest man in the world. And you don't listen to him? Wow, I could have had a V8. When you look back on this, it just unfolded to me. And I think, oh my goodness. I can give you a lot of good advice about being a good husband and father. Some of it's work, some of it's theory. Mostly things you know: be loving, be kind, be patient, be forgiving. Some of those things I'm sure you're doing. And I suggest you keep putting one foot in front of the other and just keep doing it, whatever adversity you face. Because God brings hope. And if there's one thing else we learn from the book of Job, it's that God brings prosperity in the end. That is why the message of Job is so relevant today. So, here, fathers, here's some hope for you. All that your children will learn from you won't come in the first 10, 15, or 20 years of their lives. And there will be times when you and your wife will be going through things and you just need to keep her grounded because she's going to handle grief differently or anxiety differently. The relevance of the book of Job is pretty amazing because it covers not only adult children but young children twice. God wrote the last chapter of his life, and only he can write the last chapter of your life. Consider this. Success in prosperity and success in adversity is related to our priorities. With what is my name associated? That can be a painful look in the mirror. When people say your name, when they say my name, with what do they associate those words? Are you a man of godly character? Are you active in your children's spiritual well-being? You know, I thought it was important to pray for my kids when they were young. But I've come to realize praying for them when they're older is much more important because when they're young, they're under, you know, guidance and you can watch over them and everything's cool. When they get older and they start making their own decisions, that's when it gets a little scary. So one day, as I'm reading, as I told you about the book of Proverbs and the 17 times that Job addressed his son in chapter 1 and 7, I decided to write my own book of Proverbs for my kids. All the miracles that happened in my life, in our life, the decisions we faced, my favorite songs, scriptures, stories, books. That's about 30 pages long, and I gave it to our kids. My son, who loves God, has been very grateful for it. My daughter, our daughter at the time, was away from God, and she's still away from him, but she's never said a word about it. But I'm just saying, fathers, you stand in a unique position. You owe your kids. Or is your identity framed on the foundation of your livelihood? I'm a carpenter, and that's all I talk about. I'm a dentist, and that's all I talk about. I'm a pastor, and all I talk about is ministry. You know what? I don't hang around a lot of guys like that. I really don't. Because if all I'm doing is talking about ministry, then I'm building my identity on what I do and not on who I am. Like you, I am a child of God. End of story, period. You know, and for guys, it's hard. It's hard to not allow our lives simply to be built on our livelihoods. We have to fight it every day. It's very comfortable to go back there. I close with this. The doctor who was in charge of my friend Rod Redlich's care told Ron's pastor this. He said, "It is necessary that we accept what has happened." And then he went on to quote a little verse in German, which translated says this, "Lord, send what you will, be it good or bad. I will delight in either that comes out of your hand." That's incredible faith. And I got to tell you guys, only by living for him are you going to make it, whether it's prosperity or adversity.